My name is Michael Coates, and these conversations highlight the challenges, achievements, and societal issues within social housing. In this episode, we speak with a man who has dedicated his life to supporting those most vulnerable. We talk about youth homelessness, the current housing need, the charity sector, and their amazing people. We also speak about why a home is so much more than a building. This podcast was created by Combat Pest Control in partnership with Centrepoint. Episode 3, Ed Tetherley. This is Breaking the Cycle. Ed, you left Stoll and then joined Centrepoint. When was that?
So I joined Centrepoint 3 weeks into the pandemic. So I was asked whether I'd stay on at Stoll just to get them through the grips of the pandemic. But we put all the protocols in place, so I felt, you know, I felt cool, and it was really strange. We spent the first 3 weeks of the pandemic. So my last 3 weeks at Stoll were literally doing food parcels and looking after and propping people up and helping people to isolate. And then I moved to a national organisation, which is Centrepoint. So I did it 3 weeks. So April 2020. We joined Centrepoint.
Mm. And then differences, or the initial differences, obviously we've got the pandemic, but we'll put that to aside for a second. What were the differences, I suppose, between Stoll and Centrepoint?
Two obvious differences. So the first one's got to be size. It's Centrepoint's national. We are all over the country. And so I've been there nearly a year and a half, and I'm still finding people, so, oh, God, you do that. God, what a great role. And I kind of learn about different pockets of Centrepoint. We're big enough. I think cultural as well. And Michael, more than most people, you'll get this. So the military piece, I used to wear the suit every day going into Stoll. And going into Centrepoint, it's almost like de rigueur that you've got to have like tattoos or facial jewellery or something. So I'm quite a straight head in terms of Centrepoint. But actually, I feel really comfortable. So culturally, much more organic, kind of closer to the street, closer to the cause. And I really like that. Please, it's, you know, I'm not going to judge any individual when they walk in the room. So I really like that. And there's a lot of really passionate people. So.
What is it? What is Centrepoint?
So Centrepoint is, please, there are other really good, I'm not here to be particularly partisan, there are other very good youth homelessness charities, but Centrepoint is the national youth homeless charity. We were founded in Soho in the 60s, absolutely dealing with that. That's, you know, the Cathy Come Home, kind of the start of street homelessness, because it was very, very rare. There was kind of the Orwellian sink houses and the kind of the old fashioned street drinker. But this is in the 60s, street homelessness started just to touch other parts of the population. And so there was a guy called Reverend Ken Loach in the 60s. He opened up his church in the middle of Soho dealing with youth homelessness. So now nationally we do anything between 16 and 25. But at that stage it was runaways. It was people coming out of care homes and things like that. So he opened up his church in Soho. We were just London based until the 90s, and then now we've spread our wings. So we don't do every part of the country, but we've got 67 accommodation services. We've got work and learning. We've got health services. We've got legal clinics. We've got activity stuff. We've got little offices on nearly in every major city around the country. Any given night, we're housing over 1,200 young people. We do direct support to about 15,000 young people every year. And we give some form of support, might be telephone advice or something, to over 30,000 a year.
So. And you mentioned between 16 and 25, you know, younger than 16, that's social services. What does that fall under?
So we've got the Children's Act. And so by law, the Children's Act, anyone who's an unaccompanied minor under 16, the state acts as the parent. And so I'm not going to go into the Children's Act specifically, but you'll be accommodated through care homes and fosters.
But that's the state will look after.
Social services kicks in. Yeah.
And then once you become 16, what's the situation then with regards to law?
So 16 to 18, under the Homelessness Act, you have to be housed by the state. So there are different projects and Centrepoint runs some of them. And the reason we're 25, it does coincide with the law. So from 18 to 25, the government has absolutely no responsibility to house an adult whatsoever, unless there is significant disability. It's called priority need groups. So by 18 to 25, the exception is if up to the age of 18, you were in care at any stage for over 3 months, and or you were in some form of supported housing, then the extension to house you goes up to 25. I hope that's clear.
So yeah, that's the rule. No, it is. And with regards
Centrepoint specifically, is everyone that's housed by Centrepoint, in brackets, vulnerable?
Yes.
And what's vulnerable?
So our take on it, so we don't only work with rough sleepers, and in homelessness, there's an iceberg going on, and the tip of the iceberg is rough sleeping. So look at government statistics. They say there might be around, I think the statistics, 6,000 or 7,000 rough sleepers a year. We know that street counts is a really flawed methodology. So I know estimates have been done by policy teams. Crisis released an estimate around 50,000 people rough sleep in any given year. So quite big numbers. Vulnerable for us is anyone who is likely to become homeless. And homeless is not just rough sleeping. Homelessness is a B&B. Homelessness is a hotel. Homelessness is on someone's floor. And I completely support that. Homelessness often is so much more than a home. It's a state of being. It's a complete, the floor metaphorically and sometimes literally collapses from beneath you. So it's a loss of confidence. It's a loss of sense of self. Mm-hmm. It's a loss of opportunity. You cannot live, or it's very rare, you have to really beat the odds to go and live a fulfilling life if you haven't got that platform, that base.
Society's not lined up for it. You know, look at things like the Vagrancy Act and you know, going way back in historically and then all the way through, society wants you to be somewhere where you can then operate from. And like all those things you just said then, and that safe, secure environment to then thrive beyond that. With regards, and what do you see, beg your pardon, what do you see with respect to the young people that come through Centrepoint? Typically, someone's introduced to you, what's the first point of call going through it? And then what do you see on the opposite end, the outcome, I suppose?
So we work with young people at every stage of the journey. So I'm not here to be particularly partisan, but let's use this as a portrait for what works for youth homelessness. So at the front end, we run a national helpline. So we have direct, like, telephone case support with 16,000 of people a year, and that's through the telephone helpline that we run, and that's all done through fundraising. So hi everyone, hi audience, keep on giving, it's really important. Then we don't do any in London, for instance. There's some great charities out there, but so we do rough sleeper outreach work elsewhere in the country. So that's going out into the streets, identifying individuals who just don't want to come in. They're in a very, very chaotic lifestyle, so drug use is very common, alcohol use, mental health issues. So we do street outreach. Then there's drop-ins. So again, in Manchester, we run an amazing project on Oldham Street, just outside Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester. And we work with around 1,200 young homeless people in Manchester, and they just walk into drop-ins. And there's other drop-ins in Birmingham, in London, and stuff like that. Then the likeness is the normal journey. It's not always, but the normal journey is through supported housing. So we run 67 different supported housing projects. They're staffed. They're normally commissioned by local authorities, just they're so expensive to run. It's very hard to do that through fundraising income. And then the normal journey is going from hostels into permanent accommodation. Mm. But that's so tough. Unless you are, you talked about what's vulnerable, unless you're covered by one of those things like the Children's Act or something, then if you're under 25, you don't get a full housing benefit allowance. But the biggest barrier Centrepoint's got to setting up more projects is actually less so money. It's about appropriate buildings. Housing is so expensive that housing benefit won't cover these properties. So I go to a local authority, and I've got a building, and then from a private rented source, and the local authority won't cover it. So
larger buildings or individual flats or units?
Flat, either, to be honest, literally, that such is the scale of the housing crisis. I did a webinar this morning, so it's been a busy day, but I described homelessness at the moment as like the most difficult game of musical chairs going, because it's not in musical chairs. They normally take one seat away and you go around. It's like in the first round, there's like 20 of you in the room, there's about two flats. And that's homelessness if you haven't got a home at the moment. I can trot out some more statistics, because once you move in the hostel, you're trying to get that permanent home. We need to build 300,000 homes a year just to meet the need. And I've got a great statistic, which I only read a couple of weeks ago. To meet the need of single households, and most homeless people are single households, at the moment, currently, social housing vacancies makes 7% of the need. So of in any given year for the amount of single households out there. So before we get into services and before we get into all the energy of everyone, we just need to build more houses. it is the hardest game of musical chairs going, to be honest.
Mm. And then I suppose the allocation and everything else, it's very, very complex. You mentioned issues, probably more challenges, mental health, amongst other things. What, if anything, does Centrepoint do regarding promoting and supporting good mental health with their clients, with your residents?
Yeah. Again, just enjoying working with Centrepoint and the resources we can bring to bear and the fundraising. So under my team, I've got 30 health professionals. And So we have 12 psychotherapists, which is absolutely brilliant. And we've got mental health advisors. So we're not there to substitute what the state does. We are so blessed in this country. There is state provision for young people. I know there's waiting lists. I know there's limited provision, but we've got it. So just to keep some positives, but we have, so I mentioned the psychotherapist, our mental health team, they support young people about what's quite an emotional roller coaster about going into a statutory mental health service. So they do expectation management. They do some advocacy. They do the broader well-being piece as well. Because it's great that you can get things from the state, but it can take 3-6 months to get there. Mm. So we give the support in the interim and we support them through the emotional journey through that. Mm. We also, in our health team, I've also got dietitians. So we have, twofold. A, we do the Marcus Rashford style food poverty work, just disseminating good and appropriate healthy food. But we also do one-to-one work with those with eating disorders. So that's either overeating, undereating. I was shocked by the data about the number of young people who've got disordered eating, which is the right phrase. So that's significant. At Centrepoint also, we've got a healthy relationships team. So we have two counsellors who specialise solely in supporting young people coming out of abusive relationships. So that could be psychological abuse, can be physical abuse, can be sexual abuse. There are some stereotypes around the country where it happens, and there's in every stereotype, there is a kernel of truth somewhere in there. So we support young people through the trauma process, but also about setting the standards and behaviours of what makes a good relationship so they can respond hopefully quicker, better in the future. So
talking and almost highlighting the fact that violence is not acceptable.
Yeah.
Especially if someone's gone through a traumatic childhood with parents and then going into abusive relationships, that kind of thing.
Completely. Saying yeah. that hitting someone because they've changed the TV remote inappropriately is not appropriate. You know, sexual behaviour without consent is not appropriate. Bullying, psychological abuse is not appropriate, and just trying to set that bar. And many of our young people who haven't come through stable family backgrounds just don't have that. So that's all part of our health offer. So being Centrepoint, it's like coming from, we've known each other a while, right? Going to Centrepoint, and please, there's still limited resources, but what we can bring to bear compared to so many other organisations that I've worked for is a real privilege. There's never enough, but we're giving it our best shot.
Are you oversubscribed?
Of course. Accommodation's still the most important thing, but there's the phrase homelessness in the home, and it's about that mindset. It's not just about having a home, it's about having a purpose, all the things that make fulfilment. So we will house someone, but I can put someone in a house and not support them at all, and the likes is they'll come back to our services in the future. So it is that whole holistic sense. So we have our standards, the Centrepoint standards about how we assess people, and we cover mental health, physical health, work, learning, emotional well-being, relationships, ability to live independently. All of those things are part of the support package.
Mm. Community then, do you, and you mentioned support, I want to talk about this because I think it's so important, especially with housing, the things I know and the people who I work around, the community element to it and bringing good, positive people in. One, your team, Centrepoint as a team, but then having good people around you, mentors, good, positive role models that have got maybe gone through the process or going through the process as your, I don't know if you'd call them clients, but
young people. I'm still getting used to the phrase. It was clients in the last place. So young people.
The young people you're working with. Do you promote and instill a good community spirit?
So yes. So absolutely key to Centrepoint's model is this phrase about psychologically informed environments. And the psychologically informed environment is every single touch point the young person has. So it's the physical environment. So in our supported housing, we invest a lot. We've got a £3 million programme now to invest in the physical environment. So it's literally when you walk into a room, then do we, if it's a rundown hostel and it looks like it's run on a shoestring, then the young person, is that all they're worth? Do you know that sense of worth? Mm. So we invest heavily in a lick of paint and colour on the walls and energy and all the things about that set the precedent for adult living, cushions, soft furnishing, carpets, all of those kind of things. But also the people make the environment as well. So every single one of our member of staff goes through 2 days of what we call psychologically informed training, which is about that interaction. It's about that positive role model. So every interaction is meant to instill kind of self-belief in the young person. It's meant to be a kind of co-production in the journey out of being homeless and moving to independence. So we have a team of 4 or 5 psychologists at Centrepoint, just throwing a lot into this space, talking about, you know, exactly what you're talking about. In fact, like, I've kind of been around for years in this trade, and one of my big themes at the moment is social capital, which is exactly what you're talking about. And so many of the young people we work with don't have social capital. So I plunged in. I left home literally a week after my 18th birthday. I didn't have a flipping clue what to do in my flat, but I had 20 people. But, oh, council tax, or, God, these electricity bills are big. And, oh, mum, can I borrow 20 quid? You know, all that social capital around that will just help me through that process.
Well, I've never heard it, social capital, but yeah, it's a strong social support network.
Yeah.
And it's one of the key fundamentals in maintaining and supporting good mental and physical well-being.
Yeah.
It's such an important part, and it often gets overlooked by everyone, really, and especially this last 18 months, and that's really come to the forefront. What is the situation been like over the last 18 months? What have we seen change within the organisation? Not so much from an operational point of view, but what the need is.
So you asked the question, I was going, oh, operational straight away. I was like, safe environments, everything going virtual, all of that lot. The obvious thing, you asked me about mental health earlier, and that was really obvious. So we use the CORE, which is the NHS system for measuring impact of your mental health services. So we do measurement of all our support, our key working, and that's a very holistic measurement. All the things I talked about, we aggregate work and mental health and physical health. But in the mental health side, we do CORE, and that is about risk to harm to others and self-harm. So very risk-based. And we use this measurement tool. It's the same as the NHS one. And historically, and it is back there now, thankfully, you can see as you plot the intervention. And crucially, the beneficiary and the therapist does the plotting mutually. So it's a kind of joined scoring system to try and measure progress, measure impact of your mental health services. So just traditionally, they always go up. You get quite relaxed going, oh yeah, the team are doing great. And then at the beginning of lockdown, it completely flatlined. So there was no positive impact of all the therapy and all the support we were offering. And what that meant is there were young people who were anxious, who were isolated. Very interesting how people said, oh yeah, young people don't care about the pandemic. They're not going to get ill. They're running about without masks on and stuff. Not our young people. At least young people are not homogenous, but the absolute trend was they were very anxious. They felt very isolated. They lost a lot of their sense of like what to do and stuff like that. And essentially that flatlining, we were just keeping people to hold on. Do you know what I mean? We were just supporting them to keep their head above water.
Survival mode.
Yeah, so they weren't going down, but they were just, it was the first time in all this measurement we've done over a number of years where for 6 months or so, just flatlined. We were just holding people on during that pandemic time emotionally.
And especially young people anyway, things can be confusing and it can be worrying, and especially if then you stick housing and work or the lack of it into the mix, and then again, you know, this what did you say, the social
capital,
and you start,
is my phrase at the moment.
Yeah, it's actually great. You start spending your capital, and you start running out of capital. The more you go on and on and on during isolation periods and all the rest of it, it can become a severe issue, and I certainly saw it. Just through my neighbours, you know, this almost unwilling to interact and to act differently to what you would have normally, in brackets, normally. But that is that magnified then when you've got a demographic that, again, we'll use that word vulnerable, where you're not maybe starting at 100% anyway. You might be starting lower than that with regards to well-being physically and psychologically.
I think the journey, again, young people are not homogenous, by the way, and we have some people going through our services, and she started yesterday, I've just employed a Centrepoint alumni who rough slept 25 years ago, and She didn't even put it on her application. She came through the interview. She won the interview hands down. And in the interview, she said, and the first question was the standard interview, you know, why have you applied for the job? And she said, well, I used to, 25 years ago, I rough slept and I went to local authority. They did nothing. Anyone did nothing. And Centrepoint happened to be, look, please, sir, there are other great organizations. I'm not being too partisan, but Centrepoint was the charity that was there for me. And then 25 years later, she's coming in and she's running all our health services across the whole of London. So that's, you know, a team of 20, senior manager role, and she's Centrepoint alumni. So young people are not homogenous. But the journey that so many of our young people face is not just about a home. It is that holistic sense, and it's all of the emotional journey and all of the psychological resilience. It's all of that. And so our model and all our training, all our induction, all the investment we put into staff is to try and deal with all of those issues. I'm not pretending that every single person needs Centrepoint perfectly, but we have two KPIs. So I've done the whole new performance measurement system, and literally the two KPIs are, do you move on positively? And we're about 98% of young people from Centrepoint move on positively, great results. And are you in education, employment and training? And when I joined, it was 58%. We're now at 70%. So we're going in the right direction. And they're the only two KPIs that we work to in terms of outcomes.
You look at this, you know, the media have got a big role to play in this, our perception socially, societally. Military, when people say military homelessness, they just think thousands of rough sleepers. We've been through this several times, yeah. Both ourselves, and that's not the case.
Yeah, I did the research.
Yeah, we did, exactly. We knew the research. We and that was not the case. When we think of young people and rough sleeping, homelessness, we think the worst, we think damaged individuals, we think people aren't going to contribute to society. You're saying that's not the case.
There are some people who come through services, and with the best will in the world, they're unlikely to contribute to services, to contribute to society, forgive me. But they are the exception. And do you know, it is absolutely the exception. Do you know the Children's Commission today produced a report where they've interviewed over 500,000 children, like a state of the nation's children today, and it's surprisingly upbeat. I do think it is politically driven. By the way, I'll just drop that in. I think the Children's Commissioner wants to keep the job. Just going to drop that. But what the portrayal of, and it literally came out today, and I really recommend it. It portrays that there are and we talk about snowflakes. We talk about young people, about that kind of hand, they, you know, begging bowl and just sit there just expecting life to come along to them. The Children's Commissioner's report came out today, as I say, over 500,000 children interviewed. It talks about children who actually want to pull their sleeves up, and it talks about citizens, like really conscientious citizens. They want the world to be better. They're really tuned in to climate. They're really tuned in to prejudice, to bigotry, to racism. They're really tuned in, and that's what came out really strongly. And again, young people are not homogenous, vulnerable people are not homogenous, but actually the vast majority of people have got, despite the trauma they've experienced, despite the relationships they've had, actually they are there to be good contributors to society. That's the vast majority.
Yeah, and you know, I go bang on about this a lot, and the way you grow and develop because of the trauma you've experienced, and, you know, this separate podcast to our sister podcast, Declassified, like, you know, there's just again and again and again and again, you see it continuously, but it does require support. It does require everything that you're talking about, what Centrepoint is giving, this this inclusive, all-encompassing kind of package, really. You're looking at things differently. You're not just prescribing a pill, you know. You're looking at education and mental health, and again housing and development. How is it changing? What are you seeing from, you know, your campaigns? What are we looking forward to in the future with regards to Centrepoint? Where is it going to go?
So, before we get to Centrepoint, actually, nationally, I think that the dial is turning around homelessness. I think there's a few things that are different. I think if you went 10 years ago, you think homeless people is rough sleepers. I think now you get images of families in B&B. I think that's not acceptable. I think standards of properties are not acceptable. It's hitting the media. So I think the dial is there. And so I started working in 1996 with Rough Sleepers in Manchester, and I was shocked that there was a tolerance for homelessness. And I find it weird that there's still some tolerance for homelessness, but the pandemic helped us. There was the everyone in, and they did move nearly everyone in. They did move kind of 80% or so of the Rough Sea population went in. And I think that was really, I think it proves that with political will and leadership, you can do it. So Centrepoint just released its new strategy. The biggest thing is to set out this pathway to try and end youth homelessness by 2037. What does ending youth homelessness means? Of course, families are going to break down. Of course, a young person's going to have an argument and leave home. So it's not that we're going to have a zero, but it's about having the resources and the ability to respond to the need, because at the moment we don't. Last year, 120,000 young people approached the local authorities, under 25s, and said, I'm homeless, give me a home. And as I said, like social housing could give 7% of the solution. We don't have the resources. So we've got our new strategy. You mentioned campaigning. There's a lot going on in our space around campaigning. So we're brewing up with this about ending youth homelessness message, what we need, the changes to the legislation, the houses, the types of houses. We need housing at every single, this game of musical chairs, right? We need housing at every level. If you build more really nice, expensive houses, the prices come down, they become cheaper to rent. If you need more social housing, we need subsidized rents, because at the moment, there's simply not enough. There is not enough subsidized rental property. So I can go to the local authority and go, will you pay housing benefit to house this person? They go, it's too expensive, so we can't do it. We need houses at every level. So we're not going to do it all ourselves, but we're setting out a campaign that sets out the stall to do it. And we're doing our bit to contribute to every single one. We're doing a big program at the moment called Independent Living, which is subsidized rent, modular housing, quite innovative stuff. So there's a lot of our resource going into that. I'm doing the big change program internally about our support services. So we're just trying to exponentially grow all what I talked about, the outreach work, the hostels, the health work, everything. We're just trying to exponentially grow to meet the need.
You know, when we see cockroaches running around, mice running around, damp on the walls, things, you know, electrics not working right. You know, when we see that, and it's very emotive on TV, you know, ITV run something for 2 days. And
ITV, you know, do love it at the moment.
They do love it. And is that a repairs problem within social housing, or is that a desperation problem where anything will do to get people in homes?
I've got to be quite, so my hesitancy to answer is I've got to be quite careful. So I think it's a bit of everything. I think there is a cultural issue around attitudes towards social housing. And I think ultimately, if you have a property that's that bad, you've got a leadership issue in that organization. To think that you could actually have a housing officer who has a patch and they have properties that are that bad is shocking. The worst pictures that you've seen on ITV, I think, and I know the estate, and I don't want to mention the organization, that estate was up for regeneration, so they just went, sod it. We're not investing it. But we all know, I've seen dreadful damp in Centrepoint properties, not ones we own. We leased them, kicked off, went straight to that, and then it was done within a week, because once you shine a light, people do respond. You get to the right leader, you can respond. I do think culturally there's not enough energy around the social housing space, and I do actually put that, I part that at government more. Look at the biggest...
Enough energy. What do you mean?
The will to provide a really good social housing stock in this country. So the biggest cash reduction in spending in the austerity era, and this country's struggling. Austerity, history has not judged the austerity era very well, to be honest. And the biggest single cash reduction was in the spend in social housing. But at the same time, they came up with Help to Buy that took some of that cash and put it into the middle class house buying space. Mm. Probably a lot of those families were going to buy the house anyway. So coming from my perspective, which is I'm dealing with the most disadvantaged people, I found that really harsh to take. And I understand the economic drivers for that policy decision, but from a social impact way, it was harsh. It was tough. So there is a lack of funding in this space. What it also means is that in austerity, they came up with a new funding model for social housing, where now you have the phrase affordable rent. Affordable rent is a complete misnomer. It's quite a spin. Affordable rent is actually above often what housing benefit will cover. And affordable rent is a product that social housing offers, which is a cheap or subsidized rent, but actually sometimes the most vulnerable people can't access it. So during the austerity era, the amount of social housing actually went down available. The cheap social rent went down by 100,000 units in this country.
And you're saying we need 300,000 a year
across the board built just to meet the need. Unless you want to decrease the population, but I don't think that's going to be politically very popular. But there is actually a population debate, which I'm certainly not going to introduce to this. Far too complicated. So if you're going to meet the need, you need to build a lot of houses. And I think the culture and leadership around social housing is, it's not much in the media. It's not, you know, I think it's a really big problem in this country.
Is it an accountability issue then?
Of course, each organization needs to set its own accountability. The organizations we're talking about make big, big profits. They really do. And I think, I do think the tilt towards profit, efficiency and house building, not we don't need houses, I'm making the point, against urgent meeting a social need is an issue. And I'm going to open up another debate, actually. We have a very process driven to evicting people in this country. So we regularly evict people for £2,000, £3,000, £4,000. Big piece of research came out this year. It costs the states £38,000 on average to deal with someone who becomes homeless. So why are we evicting them for £2,000 or £3,000 in the first place when it costs the state £38,000? It's that lack of joined up thinking. And again, it comes down to the will to support the most vulnerable. It's actually because the drivers are not necessarily those in the greatest.
So, and is a judge making the decision to evict someone? Who makes that decision?
The judge always makes the decision, but the housing association has not brought in the debt reduction plan or the advice agency or the mental health service or the alcohol agency.
So the help, so the help and support before it gets to the judge.
Yeah, they're following a process, which is the culture that's there. And please, there are some wonderful people working in housing associations that do some amazing work, but there is an underlying cultural issue about our social housing stock in this country. Mm. So we are process-driven evicting people, not a person-centric approach, and it's actually costing us money as taxpayers. Mm.
I did ask you about the challenges there, so that was a question. But do you ever work together? Does Centrepoint and other charities ever work together with social housing to place people? Do you have a good relationship?
Yes, mostly. Again, the level of investment we want from them as landlords isn't great, but the rents and the income we're getting isn't great either. So we work collaboratively with lots, I think about 20 housing associations nationwide are landlords that we work with where we're delivering accommodation to these people.
And you have conversation with them?
Of course.
Just so I understand this, because I don't get the full sector, is that a collaborative, there's a problem, let's solve it, or is it a business transaction going on, or a bit of both?
Yeah, somewhere in the middle. Again, this goes back to, I do think that politically in will and culture, the driver is not, let's provide what's right and what's needed for homeless people. The driver is, they're isolated different organisations, and they're trying to make money to build more houses, which is good, right? To build more houses. But actually, the whole sector is not aligned to meeting that social need. And it's there to do if we had the will to do it.
Why don't we? Because I know in the north of England, I drive through a council estate and there's loads of housing. Why can't we just move young people from down here in London up to Hull or Preston or Newcastle and slot in with housing?
I think we could perhaps do more of it, but I go back to that social capital point. So I'm about to mention some place names, so I don't want to get into trouble straight away, but there are places in Stoke, in parts of Salford, in some of Middlesbrough and stuff like that, where there are roads, where there are tens of houses that are boarded up and available. Mm. And you can buy them there are auctions for amounts of money that some people pay in rent in London. To have a young person who's brought up, let's say in London or Birmingham or Manchester or whatever, and to say, okay, we can house you, but we can put you in a terraced house and it's in Middlesbrough, Stoke, Carlisle or wherever, is a really tough ask, and you are ripping up that social capital. These are people who we talk about the whole holistic journey, and just to put them into a house means it is possible to take them through that journey, but you've just made it a whole lot harder. And it is rare that that young person would want to do that.
And your role, as we wrap up, what is your current role within Centrepoint.
So my formal job title is Director of Support and Housing. I report to the Chief Executive, but I'm responsible for the frontline services. So the services that we offer our young homeless people.
Mm. And what does that entail day to day?
Day to day, there's a good dose of leadership that's going around banging the drum, because if you include locums of part-time staff, I don't know how many staff I've got, 500-600 or something like that.
Oh, really?
So there's a lot of just going around banging the drum, a bit of leadership. Absolutely, it's also about a change and improvement program. We call it HOMES. It's an internal thing to Centrepoint, but we're going through a change program, which is the culture, the performance measurement, the review processes, the HR, the digitalization of what we're doing. There is a whole change program coming in. So I was the architect of that, and we're delivering that. And I also oversee the new business. So all of our attempts to build, like all the getting the new properties, going to local authorities to set up new services, all of that. So that's what I do.
And where can we find Centrepoint if we want to support with fundraising or want to find out more? Where do we go?
We're on Twitter, Centrepoint, I think. I'm not very good at Twitter.
I'll stick
it. Do you know what?
I
left social media when I joined Centrepoint. It's one of the best decisions of cracking well-being tip. Yeah. Leave social media, but definitely centrepoint.org. I can do that. So the website, and after social media, I think I've flunked that answer. But the website's there.
Ed, thanks so much. We'll leave it there.